Frank, may I ask, does the show of hands that you saw here in the audience, maybe 5 or 10 women at most, does that represent a fair reflection of the gender profile in your own company, Honeywell?
It's directionally pretty much the same, and I'd say in most parts of the world it is pretty typical, and I think as you're alluding, it also poses the challenge, the question, are we somehow not attracting roughly half the population to our industry?
Okay. Graham, yesterday you mentioned to me recent concerns that have been raised in the UK about the low number of women entering engineering.
Yes, I think we've got exactly the same problem in the UK. And it's predominantly about attracting to engineering. Studying STEM subjects, for example, mathematics is relatively evenly populated between male and female students. But the more science and engineering subjects are still predominantly male, and that is a concern.
Yeah. Mohammed, could I ask, as a recently graduated engineer, what is your perception of the number of graduating female engineers?
As I can see, it's a low number of female graduates, and in Abu Dhabi, to tackle this problem, for example, my university, initially it was only for men because oil and gas, and it was occupied by men for a long time. But now they opened a campus for females, and now they're joining the same courses, and they're graduated and joining the same companies, the same oil and gas companies, and they are coming to the fields also.
Ahmed, may I ask, does the show of hands you've seen here today, is it a fair reflection of what you see at GPIC?
Yes, definitely. It is at present. However, there is a big push from the government, from the companies, to encourage women to go and study engineering and so on. During the last 10 years, we see an increased number of women going to the engineering in our area compared to before.
Okay. Alberto, as a Southern European manufacturer, what is your experience on the gender matter and perhaps also on the average age of engineers?
First of all, I'm quite optimistic from the gender, let's say, in female.
A typical Italian.
Yes. It's things are getting better, in my opinion, because when I began in mid-90s, I would say we were almost 1-2% against 98-99%. These were the averages. And now things are a little bit better, and we reached almost, I would say, 7-8% as a mix of females versus males. Regarding the second point, I would say that from my perspective, from Cyprian's perspective, we are missing probably the age of engineers that are in their mid-30s up to the 50s. This, let's say, big gap is probably due for things that happened in the past, mainly in Italy. And now we are, let's say, with the young engineers in a better shape than in the past.
Okay. As a further part of some further feedback from the audience, could I have a show of hands of those people that are under the age of 35? More than I would have. Yes, Zakia, definitely. Are those people between the ages of 35 and 45? Okay. Those older than 45? And those older than 60? Graham. Can I ask, are you surprised at the results?
Yes, slightly surprised, because I think the situation that we all understand is that a lot of the skills in our industry, but in engineering in general, are held by those in the sort of 50-plus age group, which I guess we probably didn't quite bear out here, but almost. And that the problem with that may actually be exacerbated as countries extend the age of retirement, creating a little bit of a block for those who are coming through. That's one side of the problem. The other side of the problem is there just aren't enough engineers coming through, gaining that practical experience so they can become the gurus in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Ahmed, yesterday when we spoke, you raised some interesting concerns regarding the age profile of both the expatriate as well as the local workforces in the Gulf states. Could I ask you to elaborate on that a bit?
Yes, in the Arab Gulf countries, we have approximately 40% of our engineers are expatriates from Europe, mainly from Asia, India, and so on. And the expatriates, 80% of them, their age is above 48, whereas the locals, majority of the locals are the age of 30 to 40.
We have the same problem as Ahmed. Like, we belong to the same region, the Gulf region, and the age profile is, it doesn't follow any normal distribution. Just in my field, for example, it's the people above 50 and the people below 30. So the people in between are very rare. So this will create a problem in the future.
It does, however, appear that there are differing opinions on the existence, and in some cases they're actually denialists of there being a skills shortage. There are a number of people that say there is no such thing as a skills shortage. Three different parts of research I'd like to quote from. The first is from North American Dr. Ken Ryan, and he says, we used to talk about an emerging skills shortage in the United States as much as we used to talk about the potential financial crisis. Well, he says both of the crises have happened. Not only is the skills shortage knocking on our front doors, it is now residing in our living rooms as we permanently rearrange our furniture. There are two principal reasons for this. We have duped ourselves into believing that we can build a sustainable economy without the durable manufacturing activities that characterize those nations threatening to eclipse us. And by that, he's referring to the emerging powers of Russia, China, and India. We face not only an aging of the skilled workforce, but a collateral erosion of the education assets required to replenish the supply. Now, I want to contrast that with some research that was recently publicized by the University of Birmingham. I'm not able to tell you whether the research was done solely on British graduates or on University of Birmingham graduates, but the research project was titled, Is There a Shortage of Scientists? The research showed that less than half of 2009 engineering graduates were in their jobs directly related to their degree 6 months after leaving university. They also found that 1 in 5 of student graduates were not directly related to their degree. In other words, they'd moved into an associated management job. But more specifically, 1 in 4 were in non-graduate employment. In other words, working as waiters or in shops. Can I ask, Frank, does this sound familiar to you? Can I ask also, maybe you can tell me, who's smoking what?
Actually, I think you're two or three things are coming out here. One is people with the STEM type of educational background are attractive to many industries, not just engineering and science roles, but any job that requires an analytical background, which is now just about anything. Even if you're in inventory control and retail, such a background is skilled. So the demand is clearly going up. The second thing, though, that I want to address is that, you know, if you read other statistics, you'll see that there's actually huge numbers of engineering graduates coming out each and every year. But they're in places like China and India and Indonesia and others. And so we have a little bit of mismatch, if you will. Two things. We have a mismatch of where the engineering graduates are, where some of the demand is. We also have rising demand in those indigenous countries for their own skills. Whereas it is true, I think, over many years, the folks in the quote-unquote West, whether that's North America or Western Europe, benefited from immigration from those countries. As they've developed their own economies and matured, the demand is very strong at home, too. So that's another issue. And I think the third issue is, although we're graduating engineers quite rapidly in a lot of the countries, try as we might, it's hard to get 20 years of experience in 2 years. So there is an experience issue that needs to just catch up as well.
Yeah. Alberto, your opinion on the subject? Is there a skills shortage or not?
Well, I would say that from my perspective, for young graduates, we don't feel the skill shortage here in Italy. We feel, a very big skill shortage for engineers that have 20 years of experience and so on. This is a sort of, I would say, funny things. When our clients, maybe some of them are here in this room, they're asking our CVs. They were asking for skillages of lead engineers with 25 or more years of experience. And we are able to give them an experienced engineer from 5 to 15 in the, let's say, in the best case. So this is a sort of... and SIPEM is, let's say, working in many, many countries, and we see that this is happening almost in every country where we are, in India as well, in Romania as well, and also in France, for instance. So we have this, let's say, difficulties to have the, I would say, the senior level of engineers with 20 years of experience doing technical activities.
Mm-hmm. Graham Gambika, how does that sound?
I think you've identified a central issue here, which is the dichotomy between the university and colleges numbers, which are correct, and also the feeling in industry. On the one hand, the official numbers in the UK are that 12.5% of engineering graduates are still unemployed a year after graduating. And that's compared with 9.6% of all graduates. This is UK figures, but I'm sure it's not. We're not alone. So on the one hand, you would say, well, there are more STEM graduates, clearly, than applicable posts. But does that mean there's no skill shortage in engineering? Well, no, it doesn't. You know, clearly, the members of Gambika, it's their number one issue, is getting the right level of feedstock in engineering skills to develop. I think the point made about experience is key. A raw graduate is probably of less use to a company than someone who's perhaps maybe done an apprenticeship and has a little bit of practical experience to go with that academic qualification. So maybe apprenticeships are part of the solution here. But the other problem is the age-old one of companies looking at bringing in a new graduate and spending the first 2 or 3 years in intensive training, and the risk that skill will then migrate off to another company that hasn't had that expense, that can afford to pay a little more for them. So there is a reluctance to train raw graduates. And you can also argue, and I think I would in the case of the UK, that the graduates aren't coming out of university necessarily with the right life skills. They're coming out with the right qualifications, maybe not practical problem-solving abilities, maybe not communication skills, certainly not the communication skills that we need in this industry. Verbal and written communication skills. So I think there's an issue there with the quality, maybe not academic quality, maybe total quality, if I can put it that way, of what's coming out of the training institutes, and also a reluctance to do primary training within industry. And maybe apprenticeships are the answer, but I think they would have to be incentivized.
This next section we'd like to look at is, whose responsibility is it to attract more students to the subject of engineering? Is it industry's responsibility or educational institutions' responsibility? Mohammed, as you were the recipient of a recent engineering bursary, what is your opinion? Whose responsibility is it?
For example, in my case, I was attracted to the engineering, first of all, because I liked it. And then the companies in Abu Dhabi, the oil companies, they sponsored the students from the high school and attract them to the engineering discipline and pay for their tuition fees. Of course, in return, that they have to work for a couple of years. That will solve the problem. And of course, after the graduation, you have your engineering degree, and you are sure that you will not work in a discipline far away from what you studied.
Coming from Bahrain, Ahmed, would you agree with that?
I definitely agree. At the end of the day, if there is a shortage, it is the industry that will suffer. So the industry is responsible to derive and collaborate with other, all government institutions and educational institutions, universities, schools, and et cetera, to encourage and to get, push students to go into the engineering sector. And I think we are doing this quite fairly good in Bahrain as well.
Okay.
But we need commitment from the top management and executives of companies to push for this.
All right. Frank, could you start with that? We were talking yesterday about being able to move staff within your organization and not only to different departments, to different countries. Could you maybe elaborate on that?
So, yeah, a couple things. I think inherent, let me comment your question, I think inherent in there is as part of the solution is if you will, an industry-university partnership. It has to be a part of the solution. I know we at Honeywell work very closely with many, many universities around the world in everything from student outreach, just creating the interest in science and technology as one thing. We had an example of one of the student awards yesterday morning was given out. We sponsor hardware, software at the university. So a public-private partnership is absolutely essentially part of creating the buzz around it. The part you're mentioning, though, is that's kind of a bit a challenge with labor. You know, unlike, and this, please don't take me equating human beings to copper, but if you look at other things that go into the need to run our industry around the world, they flow. They flow relatively well around the world. Labor gets stuck. Labor gets stuck for a variety of reasons. People don't want to move. They have families. They have children. There are tax laws that get in the way. There are sometimes visa and immigration laws that get in the way. So labor inherently is, if you will, saddled or stuck with some constraints that other elements needed to run our business are not. And that's something I think a lot of companies try to work around in many ways, but it is inherently one constraint that there is on the flow of labor that's not there with other flows of things that are needed to run our business. And because I know people are very different than commodities, but it is an example of things that come together to make a plant work.
Alberta, Southern Europe, are there partnerships between businesses and educational institutions to attract and train students?
Yes, this is, they're in place since many, many years, I would say. In engineering, and technical activities, they have been placed, when I began, they were, starting from the high school, the possibility to perform some stages in the companies. It was obviously summertime stages, and the same also in university, and also to the possibility to develop inside the company also part of the final thesis exam. And this it's a way of having a deep connection between the universities and the companies. Obviously, this is performed, especially in Southern Europe, by the biggest companies. This is not possible for small and medium-sized companies that are, especially in Italy, the core of the size of the companies. Mm. So this is something that is possible for companies like the E&I Group, the electrical state-owned group, and so on. So it's not. It's probably, I would say, dedicated to only a small percentage of students, maybe the best of them from some university criteria, yeah. Obviously.
Yesterday, Graham and I were discussing, in South Africa, we used to have tax laws that would allow companies to write off a very large percentage of student bursary cost as a tax write-off. That was dropped by the wayside around 20 years ago. Graham was telling me the same thing happened in the UK. Graham, would you care to comment on it and the knock-on results of that?
No, exactly that. And I don't know whether this actually translates to a very international audience like this, but certainly in Britain, if we had an audience of senior people from our industry and we asked for a show of hands to say who had been involved in a sponsored apprenticeship or some kind of studentship where part of their grants or maintenance was paid by a company, you'd get a pretty high percentage show of hands because the industry is run by people who came through that type of scheme. And that scheme ended in the early 80s. I think we're all saying the same thing. And it was left up to to do it, and the number of apprenticeships and studentships fell off. And we really haven't seen a significant pickup since then. So I'd give it significant, yes.
Yeah. Mohammed?
Yeah, I think my university is a perfect example of collaboration between industry and the institution because we are not only sponsored by ADNOC, Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, we are also sponsored by BP and Shell and JOTCO, Japanese company. And in the summer internship, some students go to other companies like BP and they go to Japan and see the how they do their work and they go to JOTCO. And also, the companies for my university offer, for example, the masters and the other companies, other ADNOC companies, they encourage their engineers who have their bachelor degrees to pursue their master's degree in the same institute. And also, they encourage the technicians who have the diploma degree to go out and get their bachelor degree and come back again as engineers.
Okay. We have another question from the floor here, from a South African.
It's Neil Stunder. I think a comment made earlier is, it's one thing putting guys through tertiary institutions, but in South Africa specifically, we're seeing the quality of people that's coming out on the other side is they've got absolutely no practical experience. And we find that in the institutions there, there's just no practical anything happening while they're doing the theoretical. I mean, if you compare it, let's for instance say to a medical doctor or something, somehow they get these guys out on the other side and they can practice when they leave studying. Or at the age of 35, the guy's a specialist back surgeon or whatever the case may be. The question is our tertiary education of engineers correct? Is there enough practical during the initial stages to try and get them up to speed quicker, I guess?
Can we start with you, Ahmed? What do you think?
Yes, I definitely agree with you. New graduates have a shortage of experience, especially in communications, industrial and general day-to-day work practice. But we can do a lot of things to reduce that gap. And we are doing a lot of things in Bahrain and also in the region to reduce this gap. As I said, we have involvement from top industries in all universities, at all levels, from the board level to the classroom, up to we have committees for curriculum advisory committees. And I am a member of two university committees in Bahrain. What we do, not only we discuss and agree and design the curriculum and the subject, but also we collaborate in bringing students, final year students, to industry to learn.
Norm Gilsdorf, president of HPS, he wants to make engineering a sexy subject. If I can take an example of what television has done to make a profession sexy, let's look at CSI Miami. Who would have thought that a subject like pathology, looking through a microscope at a petri dish full of bacteria, could be a sexy subject? It's unbelievable. We've got a female journalist here. Helen has said about some of the engineering subjects, programs on television. Take megastructures, for example. It said it's very interesting, but the programs are about nerds, for nerds. They're not about nerds, for non-nerds. In other words, the programs are not appealing to try and encourage people to become engineers in any way or develop an interest in engineers. Frank, do you agree that engineering is not a sexy subject?
Well, I mean, how can you say that when you look at this panel? I mean, come on. I think to some extent we did it to ourselves in a lot of ways. I was one of those persons that raised their hand when you got a little up in the years. You know, but I grew up in the period of the 1960s when, you know, the space race and space exploration was all the rage and was in the news. And that highlighted a lot. You know, I think I can definitely say that influenced a lot of my, at least, interest in technology and science. I do think this is where, when we talk about whose responsibility is it to help stem this tide of people not going into the sciences and engineering, that's where I think it's up to us and our industries and our trade associations to point out the good things that scientists and engineers do for our economy and how they fit into making the world work. You know, some of those shows you mentioned on television are sponsored and promoted by the legal profession or medical profession and others, and taking nothing away from what they've accomplished. It's very good work. We need to do the same, right? Engineers are notorious for not wanting to engage the public. We need to do that. We need to be more out there explaining why certain projects are good for the economy of the country they're in, good for society, and we just need to be more out there.
Gambika, is there room for the member companies of Gambika, and by that I'm talking about the end-user companies, not the vendors per se, mm-hmm. Is there room for them to sponsor something potentially?
Yeah, I think so. I think we kind of have to get creative like that. I'm not sure about making a soap opera. I think some people would say day-to-day life in this industry is enough of a soap opera as it is. But I do think you can link it back to the idealism of young people and the fact that actually, if anything is going to save the world from global warming, from all the other challenges we face, it's engineering. And to me, making that link in people's minds has not been done strongly enough and needs some work to get that across.
Yeah. Alberto, any comments from the Italian industry?
Well, I would definitely agree with the topics that have been discussed here. Engineering activities mainly are performed by engineers that, in my opinion, are not so good in, let's say, giving a positive image of what they are doing to, let's say, the society and to the external, to non-engineers. Mm. It's sort of, probably this is what happens with us. We are too focused on the technical items rather than promoting the idea, the initiative, and so on. Then we should not forget that, especially in, but from my point of view, in a correct way, we have been challenged due to environment topics and so on. So engineers working in the oil and gas industry in Europe mainly are not so, let's say, cool and not so seen in a good way. They are seen probably as people who were in the past polluting and so on. So there's also this image that has to be that, and oil companies are working on this. We have to work on this topic in order to give a better understanding of what we are doing exactly in that area.
We've got a question from the floor over there.
Hi, my name is Lucie Lecoq. I work at BP in Grange Mills. It's not really a question, it's more a comment. As part of my job as control engineer, I also am a school link coordinator. I go in primary school and secondary school, and I do experiment with the kids, and I talk about what it is to be an engineer. And I usually start a session with the kids by asking them, do you know what a doctor do? And they always can answer, no problem. Do you know what a journalist do? No problem. Do you know what, you know, somebody in the bank do? Yeah. And they can answer. And as soon as I ask them, what does an engineer do? I usually get answers such as, they fix engines, they change light bulbs. They just don't have a clue what it is. And it's kids that, you know, are just a few years away from applying for a place in a university, and they're just not attracted to engineering because they don't know what it is. And I think the industry is not making enough effort to advertise to younger kids what it's like to be an engineer, what it's like to go to engineering studies. And I think we're trying to target a lot of the university, which is good, but I think we should do more work early on in even primary school, in secondary school, primary school, to try to, you know, make engineering look sexy to those kids as well.
Could you tell us something about Honeywell Space Program?
So, that's an excellent point, and I don't think we could agree more that by the time someone gets to university, they've probably relatively set their goals. One of the things we do at Honeywell to help promote science and math education careers is much earlier through a program we call Hometown Solutions, which is an international program where we'll work really with high schools, middle schools, kids that are anywhere from maybe even 10, 11 years old up to 15, just showing them what it is that scientists and technologists do each and every day. Because you're so right, you know, I've been an engineer for 30-some odd years, and I want to say that. And I'll be absolutely honest with you, I don't know that to this day my wife and daughters really fully know what I do. Some of the people at Honeywell may say the same thing. But seriously, it is a difficult a profession to explain. And again, I go back to what I said before, you know, that at least in the 60s, not just the space, a lot of technology was coming out, you know. Jet travel was becoming popular, space was evolving, handheld computers were coming out, and so there was just a lot of stuff in the public domain that was, sexy and new, and we just need to recreate that, and we need to start younger and showing kids how there's still plenty out there to develop and explore, and it's a great career.
We have another question there.
My name's Gurinder Gill. I work for Honeywell. I think the recent conversation has been very much focused on the younger generation, which I suppose is really fundamentally what we need to fix. But that's a relatively long-term fix in terms of we talked about the experience which these guys have to gain to become really the linchpin of the future. What about the problem we talked about earlier, which was this gulf of experience, the 35s or the 30-year-olds? You know, that's a more immediate problem. And how do we go about trying to resolve that?
May I say that I think the horse has bolted. We're in trouble. I don't have an answer for that. Does anybody, any one of the panel have an answer? Frank,
well,
maybe?
If someone's 35 and they're not in the industry, they're probably not going to come into it. So, you know, that's where I do think some of the things around technology that we've talked about here at this conference become at least bridges to that shortage. You know, the traditional way of doing service has been for 100 years in a technology field is you bring a person to where the problem is, either, you know, on a horse or a train or a plane. Well, with modern technology, we can bring the problem to the person, too. That goes a long way to mitigate some of the shortages, things like remote collaboration, remote tools, embedding know-how into systems and into shared knowledge databases are a part of the solution. Again, I don't, as an engineer, I don't think it can ever be the complete solution, but I think some of the technology tools we have available today, which I think can help mitigate that issue.
Helen, you were going to ask something.
Why are the engineering firms so reluctant to take on graduates to train them up? Because other professions don't have that problem. If you take the law profession, the big firms will take people on, train them. Accountancy, my brother's an accountant. He qualified with PricewaterhouseCoopers. He left and went somewhere else as soon as he was qualified. Other professions accept that that is going to happen, accept that the movement of graduates and younger employees is quite fluid. Why do engineering firms not do that?
Graham, could you maybe speak for Gambica?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I think part of the answer is that business has become very short-term in its thinking and its horizons, and that's part of the answer. And as I said earlier, there is this fear that, well, it's okay if everybody, all the major companies in the industry are playing their part, but if I'm the only one in my area that's training up engineers, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to put that investment in, and I'm going to lose that engineer. So we have to do something as a society to encourage the majority of companies to run training, apprenticeship, and studentship schemes. I mean, if I can just give a couple of examples across Europe. Companies of 500 people, employing 500 people or more in Germany, almost 100% of them in our sector, in engineering, run some kind of training or apprenticeship scheme or studentship scheme. In the UK, it's less than 20% of those companies. And I'm sure if we went across all the countries of Europe, we'd find a real patchwork quilt. So that's one of the issues. And, you know, I suppose our sledgehammer solution is what Graham and I were talking about a little earlier, which is maybe some government intervention to try and nudge companies to do the right thing, maybe some tax credits against training. It used to work. It worked in the 70s. It could work again today. It's probably the wrong time to go to government and ask for money. That's the problem.
I doubt there's a government representative here today. So whose responsibility is it to go and nudge the government to get their A into G?
Yeah, but that's partly trade associations. That's what we do. We represent the industry. It's very hard for an individual company, although companies do, of course.
As I say, you know, we do try to provide engineering training-type programs around the world at Honeywell. Here in EMEA, in Europe, Middle East, Africa, we call it JETPRO, Junior Engineer Training Program. In North and South America, we're not as eloquent. We just call it the farm team. But basically, we bring kids out of university anywhere around the world, and over about a two-year period, we rotate them between various parts of the organization. So they'll work in engineering, they'll work a little bit in estimating, proposal writing, some in development. And this is where I was told I could be maybe a tad bold on some of the things I'm going to say. I was meeting with the UIS committee in Phoenix about a month ago, and this same question got posed about not having engineers with good hands-on experience coming to their site. So I do think the service companies like ourselves and the engineering companies have an obligation to be a part of that. But I would also ask that our customer base needs to also be a part of it as well and at least be welcoming of some of our junior engineers onto their sites and their projects. We can't deliver to you engineers that have had hands-on experience unless you allow us to at least put them as a trainee on the site. That, to be candid with you, my experience has been harder and harder over the years than when I first came out. I mean, I was one of those ones that went along as a trainee for a long time. So I think we can do a part of it, but I think those we serve need to, again, it's never a good idea to tell your customers what they need to do, but at least be open to us bringing a trainee as a part of the team.
We've got to wrap in a moment, but could I ask you, Alberto, in a summary for what you would have to say to that?
Yes, we. I think that mainly the biggest companies, the major companies, should believe firmly in performing internal training in a structured way, deploying also basic engineering trainings and specific training to, let's say, their business. And we are performing this, and all the major companies are performing this, I believe, all over the world. I do agree that in some area, in some fast-growing companies, I personally experienced that we are training a group of engineers, and within 3 years, we're going to lose them completely. But I think that we should go on with this process because we firmly believe that this is the only way to, let's say, cover this gap due to the lack of engineers coming from university or in some areas to, let's say, not completely fitting to our purpose the skills that we got from university.
So I'd like to thank our panel, Frank, Mohammed, Graham, Ahmed, and Alberto. Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you for your time.